Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week I'm happy to say that we have Tom Kestner on the show, and we'll be talking about his terrific new book, The Flight of the Century, Charles Lindbergh and the Rise of American Aviation. You know exactly who Charles Lindbergh is, and for good reason, because he's still famous. And at the time that he flew the Spirit of St. Louis across the Atlantic from New York to Paris, he was, or rather became shortly thereafter, the most famous person in the world. This is really a key element in Lindbergh's life and in the life of the United States, or the history of the United States and the world, because Lindbergh represents the moment at which celebrity became a kind of dominant force in American culture. And I guess I would also say world culture. Lindbergh, as you probably know, didn't handle celebrity very well, which made it all the more interesting. This is also a kind of story, the fallen celebrity that we've become very used to. Lindbergh is probably the first example of it. Tom does a terrific job of telling the story of Lindbergh's life from his early childhood in Minnesota to the flight across the Atlantic and then afterwards in his kind of long and dramatic decline. I really encourage you to go out and read the book because I enjoyed reading it and I enjoyed talking to Tom today very much. So, without further delay, here's the interview. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Marshall. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you today?
Okay. It's a nice day out here.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I should tell our listeners that we have Tom Kestner on the show, and we'll be talking about his wonderful book, really wonderful book, The Flight of the Century, Charles Lindbergh and the Rise of American Aviation. As I was telling Tom in the pre-interview, this is a really fantastically written book. Tom has a narrative gift that I think very, very few of us have. I certainly don't have it. My writing style is a little bit like, I don't know, I told Tom in the pre-interview that it was more like a PowerPoint presentation than anything.
I got that, but okay.
Oh, come on. It's a very impressive book, and it's absolutely beautifully written. As I say, you have a terrific narrative gift, and I really encourage people to go out and pick it up. Yeah, because it's a lot of people will know the story of Lindbergh, but I think that in your retelling, it's really just a marvelous read. So why don't we begin the interview, Tom, by having you tell us just a little bit about yourself?
Okay, my name is Thomas Kestner. I was born actually on the other side of the ocean. I was born in Germany after World War II in Bergen-Belsen, and came over to the United States in 1950. Educated here and did my undergraduate work at Brooklyn College, where I became fascinated with history, particularly because of my parents, who had been in concentration camps and who underwent the turmoil of World War II, how much of part of the previous decade's history, previous period's history they had been. And it fascinated me, story full with the lives of people, leaders, but common people as well. And one of the first things that I paid attention to in my own graduate work was the history of people living in cities, but also immigrants who came to the United States. So I did that work at Columbia after graduating from Brooklyn College, and did my PhD work in Columbia under a man who really opened my eyes to the way one could do history about local areas, about cities, and about the metropolitan regions that had developed in the United States. And that's Kenneth T. Jackson, who is perhaps the outstanding urban historian in the United States today.
That's really quite a success. That's really an American success. That's Horatio Alger right there. You just told us you're Horatio Alger. I'm not going to.
Oh, okay.
You don't have to say it, but I'll say it for you.
Well, thank you very much. But actually, the first book that, which was my dissertation, that was published, talks about the Horatio Alger myth in the United States and about the story of immigrant mobility. It compares Italians and Jews in New York City in a critical period between 1880 and 1915, and tries to understand why it was and how it was that these two immigrant groups ultimately made it in the United States and what that period was like as a time when immigrants were able to come, start at the very bottom, and make their way up.
That just must have been terrifically engaging for you as an immigrant yourself. I envy that experience very much. You know, I did most of my work on people that have been dead for 400 years who came from another continent. I don't identify with them at all. Let me tell you that.
Well, there is one benefit: they can't complain, and
they can't. Yeah,
you know, they can't tell you that you've done it wrong.
Yeah, arguments with the dead, I never lose. I come out on top every time. So why don't you tell us how you came to write this book?
Well, I've written four books about various aspects of urban history. And was looking for something that would give me a chance to do a little bit more of a narrative type of a piece of work. And I had written a biography of Fiorello LaGuardia 2 books ago, and I wanted to go back to trying a biographic form. And looking around, I thought we had transferred from an age of heroes to what seemed to be an age of celebrities. Mm-hmm. And I think that Charles Lindbergh was on the cusp of that change. Yeah. I mean, here was somebody who absolutely clueless about what the impact of what he was doing when he took that flight across the ocean, what was going to be. He was concerned throughout that flight with what was going to happen when he lands because he didn't have a visa. He had no idea that he would have a place to stay, and he was concerned about that. And when he came to Paris, after flying across the ocean and doing what nobody had ever done before, in fact, with 6 people who had recently tried, who were outstanding aviators, had died trying. When he finally came to Paris, he saw all these lights, and he figured he must be in the wrong place when he was over the airport, because what were all these lights doing in the airport? The airport was supposed to be dark, isolated, secluded, and he was going to land there, and then he was going to try to figure out a way to take care of himself. And instead, he sees all these lights. He turns back. He turns back for about 10 minutes until he finally decides, yes, this must be Le Bourget Airport near Paris. And what were all those lights? Those were cars that were parked outside. Hundreds of thousands of people had made their way to the airport. It was a transforming moment for the people of Paris, but it was something entirely unexpected on the part of Lindbergh. But from that point forward, he would be the world's greatest celebrity. More pictures, more newsprint, more video and movie tone footage than anybody else in the world, and then he would have to deal with it. But I think that was a kind of transforming moment, because we've kind of moved away from the age of heroes to the age of celebrities, and I thought that would be, you know, Lindbergh would be an interesting figure to help me figure that out. Also, this was the time when Philip Roth's book about The Plot Against America, in which he imagined Lindbergh running for the presidency.
Yes, I haven't read it, but I know just what you're talking about.
Yeah, it was exactly when that was a bestseller. So obviously that brought Lindbergh to my attention. And lo and behold, at the end of the book, the person who is the hero as opposed to the Lindbergh protagonist is Fiorello LaGuardia, someone whom I studied. So, you know, this caught my attention. And I figured, then there's just one last thing, and I think that if we look around, there's a great deal of lip service to democratic ideals, but there's this American tropism toward rightist solutions, and I think that fit with what I'd read in the book, you know, The Plot Against America, the way that Lindbergh was portrayed. Now, I want to know more about this guy and about how heroes work in this country.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think that all of that, the birth of what we might think of as the star system writ large, comes out very clearly in the book, and it's really I'm sorry about all these compliments. It's really masterful how you teach us that lesson and then tell us the story as well simultaneously. I tend to be so didactic, you know. I'm just going to tell you. Maybe it's because I'm a Midwesterner. I don't know. I'm just going to tell you the punchline right away. I'm going to give you the lead.
I've got to control that. I have that tendency as well. But I thank you very much.
But no, it really is very nice. So why don't we begin telling Lindbergh's story? Where is he from, and what was his family like, and things like this?
Interestingly, Lindbergh is also from the Midwest, Minneapolis. Little Falls, Minnesota. I don't know how I got Minneapolis in there, but his childhood it was something that I was very curious about, because I had thought about this hero, Midwestern hero, kind of all-American boy, and he grew up in a broken home. his father was a congressman. His father was a very wealthy person, and then he lost a lot of his money. He lost his first wife, married a woman who could never get happy out in the Midwest. She came from Detroit. She was miserable. After the first few years of marriage, Charles was the only son. They had a sham marriage, totally separated. The father lived in Washington, where he served in Congress. And Lindbergh grew up alone with his mother, and he grew up as someone who loved solitude, mm-hmm. someone who could not mix with too many friends. He enjoyed much more the outdoors, being alone. And I guess perhaps this had a lot to do with the way that he was the son of a congressman who had to keep a story secret, and that mm-hmm. secret was that his parents were divorced or virtually divorced, and he'd actually seen his mother threaten to kill his father. It was a broken home, and one in which he grew up totally isolated, but he was fascinated by machines. He was fascinated at first by the smallest little things that he was able to put together and take apart. This was, after all, the age of people who like to tinker. And those tinkerers, in this period as in no other time, those tinkerers became innovators in machinery and in technology. And Lindbergh was fascinated by the kind of work that they did. He drove a motorcycle from the age of 10, and became quite proficient at taking parts of it apart. And by 12, he was driving a car. And in those days, when you drove a car, you had to know what to do with it once it stopped or it didn't work. And he was technically and in terms of mechanically, he was precocious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the word that comes to mind, precocious. He reminds me a little bit of, I'm sorry to interrupt, but
sure.
We interviewed a fellow that wrote a really excellent biography. I can't remember his name right now. About John Muir. And John Muir was the same way. He became really uh-huh. fascinated with gadgets.
Uh-huh.
And he
uh-huh.
spent his entire, he just loved gadgets. And he built all kinds of crazy things. And, he was a Scotsman who transplanted to America. But he had a similar sort of fascination about the same time with gadgetry. And went on to great fame in a different
Yeah, very different.
Anyway, go ahead.
No, I think that part of this comes out later in life when Lindbergh is somebody who has great trouble in terms of interpersonal relationships. I mean, he definitely identifies much better with machines and does much better in solitude than he does in kind of social mm-hmm. situations mm-hmm. or even in terms of marriage. I guess we'll talk about that a little bit later mm-hmm. on. But while he was precocious in terms of mechanics, he was not a student at all. He went to 12 different schools. He flunked out of college. And I think that if not for aviation, he was somebody who probably would not have had too great a future, despite his strong, his abilities and his ambition. And he probably, this was the one thing that he liked. He couldn't force himself to study. He couldn't force himself to write. He had a great discipline, but it had to be hitched to something that engaged him. Mm-hmm. And aviation in those days engaged him. It was the early days of aviation when anybody who wanted to could get into a plane and take it up into the sky, and the sky offered him a very different dimension. On Earth, he was not doing too well, but in the sky, he was alone. He could see further than anybody else. He felt this enormous sense of superiority in terms of what it felt like to be in a different dimension from where the rest of the world was, which he looked down upon these people as kind of ants crawling around the earth while he had the superior vision once he got up in the air. And that was a full mystique about people up who were flying. They might put as great an intellectual veneer on it as they wanted to, but these guys were wild people. They were taking great chances, and a good many of them died when they took these planes up in the air because these were unsophisticated machines. He became a barnstormer. That is to say that he would do tricks, climb out on the wings of planes. He could climb from one plane to another. He did that for a couple of years, and then he figured that he might as well learn how to really fly a plane rather than just do tricks and collect a little bit of money, because this was not going to be the way. He was fired by an ambition to do something that would catch the attention of his local community, but also the larger world.
Mm-hmm.
And this was not going to be the way to do it, making a few bucks, hanging out with people. And he had a strong moral sense. He was raised with it. He accepted it. He was a fellow who was hanging out with aviators who loved to go whoring and drinking and smoking. And he avoided every one of those activities, saying that these just weakened him. If he was going to abandon himself to these sorts of things, he was not going to be able to do what he wanted to do. He never actually even went out with a woman until he was 25. He he's kind of ascetically committed to the notion of aviation. And there's another half of this notion about aviation. It was not just that he's going to get up in the sky and see further than anybody else. It was this notion that aviation allowed nations and allowed individuals to kind of break down walls. I don't know if most people would remember, but I'm old enough to remember this, the early days of the computer and the internet, and the notion that this was going to allow us to transcend our limitations, to transcend national boundaries, to transcend everything so that we could be all part of one great world. And this was going to create peace and a kind of a conversation among all peoples from all corners of the earth. And he saw aviation exactly that way. He bought into this notion of the gospel of, the winged gospel, the notion that aviation was going to transcend barriers between nations.
Mm-hmm.
All this despite the fact that aviation had begun to be used in World War I and had fried a good number of people already in dogfights and a number of other things. But he thought that was a misstep. But instead, aviation was going to do great things. It was going to bring peace to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so it captured his imagination, and he went off to get training in Army Aviation School, did very well. For the first time in his life, he surprised himself that he was able to put himself into a course of study in ways that he had never been able to do before, studied to pass exams, and when he didn't do well on the first set of exams, and if you don't do well after a couple of weeks, you could wash out, as a good many of those who were in that early class did. He buckled down, and he graduated and got his wings, he was at the top of his class. So this was somebody who had one major ambition. Later he would have others, but it was one at a time. He was entirely focused. He was a person who worked in solitude, a person who did not carouse, and a person for whom aviation meant everything. Religion, he discarded. Politics, which was what his father was about, he discarded. None of these he thought could bring about what aviation could. So this captured his imagination entirely. He trained himself, and ultimately he became one of those who flew a small little airline that was centered in, I call it an airline. It was actually a business that was made up of three or four discarded planes that were, just one step ahead of the junk pile. And what this business did was to deliver the mail, because the one area of in the United States where aviation had a possibility after World War I, I'll just mention what happened in a second, but was the airmail system that was run under the postal system in the United States. Beginning 1918, they started to use airplanes to more quickly deliver the mail across the United States. And this was the one place where aviation had a possibility, because after World War One, where the United States had spent actually $1 billion to develop an air force and to invest in air flight under the press of the war, the United States abandoned that entirely. That is to say, government funding was stopped. Every effort to control even licensed airplane flying was stopped. The United States stepped back from having anything to do with flying as a government project. In Europe, that was not true, so that Europe went way ahead of the United States in terms of the use of commercial flight. In the United States, the only thing that allowed people like Lindbergh, who were in love with flying, to make a living with either barnstorming or getting a job with delivering the airmail. And the problem with delivering the airmail is that you were not flying passengers. So the pressure on you to deliver was enormous because worst comes to worst, if you crashed, all you lost was a sack of mail and yourself, but you were expendable. And in fact, great numbers, as many as a third of those who flew for the airmail perished because of the dangerous conditions. What this proved for Lindbergh was a tremendous training ground. He flew night flights, even when there were no lights. He had to make his way across. He parachuted out three times to save his life. In fact, he was the first during training. He and one other person were the first to drop out of a plane with parachutes and be saved. And then he did this two or three other times. Had he come 2 years earlier, he would never have made it. He would have been among those the casualties. So that leads up to his situation in 1926 when he is flying for Robertson Airlines, flying airmail regularly between St. Louis and Chicago. And living among these happy-go-lucky daredevils, and he realizes this is not much of a future. And he was not going to make his mark by doing this, and he was not going to make much money either. What many of the better pilots were doing at this point was paying attention to all kinds of contests. One of the ways in the United States that in a kind of free enterprise system where the United States government was not subsidizing research and development in any area or not in most areas, it was not, and certainly not in flight. One of the ways that those who were interested in flight were able to push it ahead, and this was true across around the world as well, was to create contests. So that the contest for the best motor, the contest for the best airplane chassis, contest for those who could fly the longest way, created a system of research and development. The only problem, the only difference was that those who did the research and those who did the development did it out of their own pockets and at their own risk. And if it worked, then it became absorbed into the industry. If it didn't, then there was another lesson that the industry learned. And all this was done at no expense to the government, no expense to the taxpayer. So these contests were a regular part of aviation, and one of the outstanding contests was the contest that was launched by a New York hotel owner, Raymond Ortaig, who came from France and loved his home country and cherished the notion of a alliance between the United States and France. That alliance had become eroded a great deal after World War I because of disputes and disagreements over post-war policy and over debt that remained after the war. And he thought that a contest for a nonstop flight between New York City and Paris would be great. That would, first of all, it would bind the two cities together, it would bind the two nations together, it would show what possibilities existed for airlines, for air flight, well beyond having this as a kind of sport diversion for people who wanted to go up for a couple of minutes and look down at the earth. And that's pretty much what it was. It was that plus barnstorming, where they would go to carnivals and these guys like early Lindbergh would thrill them with their exploits. But this was an exotic machine. It was not regular. It was not part of the regular way in which Americans thought about travel. And Ortaig wanted to advance aviation in that regard in the United States. And so he put up this contest. He put up $25,000 for the first person, first flight that makes it across nonstop from New York to Paris or Paris to New York. And this was something that proved impossible in the first. He did this in 1919. It proved impossible for the first 5 years till 1924 because the engines to be able to do that just weren't. They didn't exist. The plane would have to be too heavy. The engines could not carry it. And the fuel that was necessary would overload the plane. So it didn't happen through the first few years, although there were transatlantic flights, but they were not nonstop, and they were not done by individuals, and they were also not done all the way to Paris. So they were from New York to the, you know, to Ireland, to the very beginning of the continent, but not all the way to Paris. So this was more than 33,000 miles, and Ortaig put this up again in 1924 when the first contest expired. And he, this time, thought that there was a reasonable possibility that people would be able to make it across. He has this available, and there are, because people in the aviation industry are trying to make a reputation, and there was no better way of making a reputation than capturing the headlines. And by 1925, 26, the newspapers are in love with the airplane. In fact, many newspapers are also sponsoring contests.
Yeah, I actually wanted to jump in right there, and maybe we could talk just a little bit about that context, because this really is an attempt to make news on the part of the news organizations themselves, isn't it?
This is true. This is true, and this was one of the ways in which you you made news. That is that you put some money up, and then you had some daredevil or a group of daredevils make their best efforts to win that money.
Yeah, this is kind of the origin.
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt. This is kind of, I used to work in the in journalism a little bit, and this is kind of the origins of what I would call stunt journalism, which is now everywhere. People just doing wacky things, like the guy who lived for a year according to what you would find in Leviticus.
Or people who sat on top of flagpoles.
Right, exactly. That's exactly
or danced
it.
As long as they
yeah,
could
exactly.
and stay on their feet.
Yeah, exactly. But this is kind of the origin of that, and it's really making news. It's a kind of bread and circus that is sponsored by news organizations. I found it very interesting that Lindbergh was a part of this, that it really couldn't have happened any earlier, and it could have happened later, but Lindbergh was the first kind of big example of this.
Absolutely. And he became, interestingly enough, this is what drew his attention to the possibilities of this flight. The news organizations that paid attention to what he did projected him into world fame. And accomplished what he wanted. That is, that he accomplished what he wanted. He got to use the newspapers and the publicity that they provided for aviation's purposes, for his own purposes. And then at the end, he finds it impossible to live with the celebrity that all this had cooked up.
Mm-hmm.
As you point out, since there was a beginning of this kind of exchange, where you know, when you're going to become a celebrity, the exchange that you make is that you're going to use the newspapers for your own purposes, and they're going to use you. And you and there's a compliance and there's a complicity, right? There's a kind of codependency, and he couldn't deal with the other half of that.
Yeah.
He couldn't deal with the intrusions. He couldn't deal with the fact that his life had become all of his private things had become public, and that he had become this thing that he himself did not recognize.
Okay,
but that's part of the latest story.
Yeah, let's step back to it. So he hears about this prize, and this is really one of his – to be a little bit uncharitable to him, this is his one great idea, how to do this. He has an idea that I think nobody else has about how to pull this thing off.
Exactly. One of the challenges when I started this book was something that William Buckley wrote in a review of an earlier biography of Lindbergh by Brandon Gill. He said that and he was very charming in the way that he wrote, and Brandon Gill was a friend of his, and he says that, you know, my friend started with this book about Lindbergh, and it's a great book, and it talks about a lot of things that Lindbergh did, but there's one challenge at the center of that book that I don't think that he dealt with, and that is, why would something that was essentially a stunt, a sports stunt, capture not only the imagination of the world, but last for more than 15 minutes, and project this guy into heroism. Mm-hmm. Not just simply into you know, great sports figures, not just Babe Ruth. He was Babe Ruth plus so many other things. He became a kind of international figure. Why? What was so important about this? And so that was, I took that up as kind of my challenge.
Mm-hmm.
But to go back to your question, here's Lindbergh. He sees that there are possibilities. And what he was before that was one of many, many unknown people who toiled with airplanes. And here was a possibility for doing something that would project him into a much bigger field. He wanted to do it. He had no money. He had no plane. He had no training. And he wanted to do it. And the ambition and the audacity is great. I mean, there are certain elements that are extraordinary about him, and this is one of them. So he sets plans. And Lindbergh, just like with Taking Apart a Machine, he is great in sitting alone and writing down plans. You know, he's got four or five different plans. One is the plan how to catch people's imagination. One is the plan for actually getting a plane. One is the plan for how do you plan for packing the plane and getting it across the ocean. One is a plan for how he's going to teach himself navigation. All of these plans. This guy's 25 years old. He wants to do something. He's never flown a plane over a long distance except as part of this, couple of hundred miles that he flew as an airmail pilot. He was very good. He was an extraordinary pilot, and he had great instincts. But that's it. Now, what's he going to do? So he decides that he's got to raise some money. Meanwhile, there are great aviators. There are people who made their reputation in World War One. People who were dogfighters and daring, very stylish and daring. And then there was Admiral Byrd. I mean, there was Richard Byrd who had made history by flying to the North Pole, and he was going to do this. He was competing. And then there were others who had been great navigators, and they were going to compete. And over the next few months, six different efforts, six different people in several different efforts perish in trying to get their planes off the ground. And other planes, like Byrd's and Chamberlain, another flyer, suffer crashes. There were several problems about getting a plane across the ocean. One of them was that you needed to fill a plane with more fuel than anybody had ever filled a plane before. And that fuel was flammable, and that fuel was heavy. So how do you deal with that? Plus, you've got to fly over places where you've got to make a choice. You've got to essentially, you can make the flight much longer and fly over places where ships go back and forth. And if you fall into the ocean, they'll see you, and perhaps they can even save you. Or you can go across what was called the Great Northern Route, which would take you where no shipping can go, take you over the ice territories and areas where nobody will know if you disappeared. Lindbergh chose that one because that was shorter. He was developing a theory. The theory was that you need to get from here to there by conserving as much fuel and weight as possible. The most important thing was to fly light. He was the only one who had this idea. The others thought differently. They thought that they would equip a plane with everything that it needed. It could be luxurious. It would be heavy. It would carry three or four people because you needed a navigator and a pilot, and you needed a mechanic, and you needed a radio man, so that they would carry three or four crew members. And then they would just strap on as many engines as necessary to make up for the, to provide the power. And they would try to find as long a runway as possible so that it would allow the plane to build itself, build as much momentum as necessary, get itself off the ground, and fly across the ocean. This failed three times with deadly consequences. The last time that it failed was when a pair of Frenchmen tried to cross the ocean from Paris to New York and disappeared. And this happened within weeks, within a couple of weeks of when Lindbergh thought that he would himself try this. What was wrong with this theory? Lindbergh thought what was wrong with the theory was that the planes were much too heavy. And by the heavier the plane, the more fuel you needed. The more fuel you needed, the heavier the whole package was. The heavier the whole package was, the dangers of takeoff were enormous. And then that was the problem. Except for the Paris flight, the other two never made it past takeoff. Mm-hmm. And the planes incinerated once they were not able, you know, they bounced up and down a couple of times, and then they all flipped over, and then the fuel caught fire, and the people in them were burned to death. Lindbergh decided that he was going to take a light plane, and it's true that a light plane is going to be buffeted by the winds and by storms and by other things, but he was willing to take that chance. He was going to take a light plane, fill it with the plane was going to be stripped to its bare essentials, and it was going to be filled with fuel. It would essentially be like some described as a plank of wood with fuel tanks strapped to it. And he was going to try to get that across the ocean. Nobody trusted him to do this. I mean, airplane manufacturers did not want to get stuck with a guy crashing their plane, even if he paid for it, because it would ruin their reputation, it would ruin their business. So he couldn't get a plane. He was looking at all of it, finally found a small company out in San Diego, Ryan Airlines, that was willing to make the plane. And while other planes that were going across, for instance, the Bird plane would cost well over $100,000, Ryan was going to make this plane for $6,000 plus the cost of the engine. Altogether, it would cost close to $12,000, much, much less than the other planes. It would have nothing in it except for fuel, a few gauges, and a wicker seat for him to sit in. And that was it. His head was literally, his head carved a kind of space in the ceiling because he was a tall guy, 6'2½". And this was made low. The ceiling was made, I call it a ceiling, but it was the head, the top of the cockpit. It was made low so that it would have the proper aerodynamic benefits. And there were a lot of innovations. And Lindbergh did one thing that none of the others did, and that is that he went there and he watched as the plane was being constructed. It was constructed to his requirements. It was constructed in 2 months. And it would take longer. There was no way that he would be able to win this contest because the others were well ahead of him. And the plane would cost $12,000. The problem here was that he didn't have $12,000. He didn't have $2,000. He had $2,000, and that's about it. To skip over that quickly, he was able to get some people in St. Louis who had dreams about making St. Louis the airport hub of the United States. He was able to get them to back him and to raise the money for it. So money was raised. He signed a contract with Ryan. Ryan, in fact, came in exactly on time 2 months later with an airplane that he was able to fly. Lindbergh still is not being mentioned in newspaper articles because everybody else is paying attention to Bird, Chamberlain, and a number of other flyers, and including those from France. Lindbergh makes a record-breaking flight from San Diego to St. Louis and from St. Louis to New York. Finally, the newspapers pay attention to him, and he becomes not only someone who's described in the newspapers as handsome, young, and a daredevil, but he becomes the favorite. He becomes an underdog, but a favorite, a kind of pet of the newspapers. And because he was unknown, and because he was so handsome, and because newspapers were running pictures, and because of the fact that the others were all so established and so respected, his story takes on an enormous kind of a curiosity, it fills with curiosity, and takes on a real kind of symbolic importance. So here, six men had died, there was a contest between three here in the United States about who would get off first, between Bird, Chamberlain, and now this latecomer who came late with this tiny little plane who thought he was going to make it across the ocean. And there's one more innovation, and this innovation drove everybody crazy. He was going to try to do it himself. He was going to try to stay awake well over 30 hours, fly this crude contraption that had... He was not going to put a radio on because the radio was too heavy. So he was going to try. He was going to fly. There would be no radio contact. There would be no navigation assistance from the ground or from the ocean. Others would be getting regular reports from ships through radio contact. And he was going to do it alone. Bird flew with four people. Chamberlain was going to fly with two co-pilots. This guy said he was going to stay awake through the night, through the day, whatever it took, and he was going to make it to Paris. So this took on an enormous kind of aura of this kind of Horatio Alger, story. Newspapers fell in love with it, and they played up the contest. Problem, as I mentioned before, two men take off from France. Lindbergh is so shook by the idea that these guys are coming from France, and they are great airplane pilots, that he started thinking about something else that would capture attention, and maybe he would fly the other way around, that is to say, over the Pacific. That goes on for a day or two. These guys took off from France. No news. And within two or three days, France is thrown into a kind of, the entire nation is thrown into mourning. These two men, France itself, the country, had been taken over by this notion of flight and the romance of flight and what it might mean. It was in the forefront of all the nations in the world in terms of this love of the technology and what the airline and what the airplane represented. And here were these two men who took off, daredevils, who said they were not afraid to die, that they were going to conquer the ocean, and they disappeared. Even to this day, we don't know where they are, what happened to them. They disappeared. And France, the feeling in France was so so down that the American ambassador wired the State Department, asking the State Department to suggest to all who were participating in this contest to hold off, because he was certain that the response in France would be violent, especially because there were rumors that Americans had not given the right weather information to the two flyers, and that perhaps that had played a role in their disappearance. It's not true, but the rumors were believed enough so that the American flag was torn down in France. And so Ambassador Herrick asked that nobody do this for a while. Didn't matter. Here in the United States, they weren't paying attention. They continued with their plans. And when Lindbergh got to New York, he saw that everybody else was doing it. He was going to do it too. May 20th, a whole week before that, there were rains in New York, and there were rains across the ocean, so therefore it was dangerous for anybody to take off in these tiny little planes, especially in a tiny little plane like his. Everybody was delayed, but everybody was anxious, and the newspapers kept playing it up, and after a while, there was nothing much that they could write about the weather, so they playing up every aspect of the flight and of the contest. And finally, Lindbergh gets a weather report that says that it might be clearing by the next day, May 20th. He realizes that the only way he's going to steal a jump on the others is if he takes that chance. And May 20th, early in the morning, night before, he prepares. He scooted out of a play that he had gone to with a couple of his friends, and they go out to Roosevelt Field in Long Island, New York City, and they start their preparations. He had been up for more than about 20 hours. And now, after all those preparations, at about 12 o'clock, he's driven back to the hotel in New York City where he's going to take a couple of hours of rest. He asks a friend of his to sit outside and to watch nobody to serve him. And suddenly, just as he's about to fall asleep for a couple of hours, he has a knocking on the door, opens it up, and it's his friend standing there. And he says, "Come in, what's the problem?" And he says, "Gee, I'm scared. What am I going to do without you?" And Rick says, in the way he describes this, that was it for the sleep that night. And he wasn't able to fall back asleep, threw a guy out as soon as he could. And by 2:30, he sets out for the airfield. Bottom line is that he had not slept for 30 hours before he gets into the plane. And that means he's going to stay another 33 hours without sleep. This turns out to be the single most challenging part of the flight. Takes off from Roosevelt Field early in the morning of May 20th, 8 o'clock in the morning. He had a series of different cutoff points where if things did not work, he would turn back. One of the major ones was that he would see if he was on target with his map, the map that he had laid out, a map that he himself had that was based on the navigation that he taught himself in San Diego while the plane was being built. And if he was on target within a couple of degrees, he was going to go forward, and that means he was going to make the decision to go over the ocean. And at that point, nobody was going to know what happened to him for quite a while. So it was an important decision. He gets to Nova Scotia, which was the point where he was going to check, and he sees that he's remarkably on target. And so he makes a decision to go further. Several times through the flight, he faces storms, ice storms. He has to go very high up. Then he has to bring himself down because ice develops on the wings, which is the single most dangerous thing that could happen to him. And to a plane making its way across the ocean, ice would kill it would kill the balance of the wings. It would also kill his gauges, and he would not know what was happening. Therefore, he would not be able to control altitude and everything else. And it was extremely dangerous. And fortunately, he was able to correct that by bringing the plane down into a lower altitude where it would melt, the ice would melt, and he makes his way for many hours across the ocean through these storms and through an ice storm and through a cloud that is filled with a kind of terrifying ice, and suddenly he turns around and there are phantoms in the plane. And he doesn't know. He describes it 25 years later in the book that won the Pulitzer Prize for St. Louis, with the same sense of reality as if they were actually sitting there. And he believed to the end of his life that phantoms joined him across the ocean. And they have no substance, but they are there and they are real to him. And they stay with him for a while. And then as suddenly as they were there, they suddenly departed, and it helped him stay awake. That plus every once in a while slapping his own face and so forth, he finally is over Paris. It's 33 and a half hours after he took off from New York, and as I said at the beginning, he sees all this light and he doesn't know where he is. And he turns around again, sees the Eiffel Tower, and finally he decides, yes, that's where he ought to be. And if there's light down there, it's not a city. He's not going to land on top of people. It is still the airport, and he finds the proper place. He's about to land, and he is scared because he's coming to a place where he has 27 cents in his pocket, or roughly so, no toothbrush, no reservation in the a hotel, and no visa. Comes down, and it's tumultuous. It's 100,000 people breaking down barriers, pushing down gendarmes, breaking past everything to get to him. And it's incredible. Suddenly he's caught up. Two people pick him up on his shoulders, and they take off his helmet. And meanwhile, he's begging for the police to protect his airplane, mm-hmm. which he loved, which he identified with. which he gave right up, just as he's about to land. He's got an entire factory at Lorion that worked day and night. He's got his mother who raised him and was alone with him and took care of him. He's got the backers in St. Louis who put their money together. The one thing that he gives great gratitude to in his recollections, even many years later, is his plane. In fact, the first biography that he published about him says is we, him and his plane. As I said before, he has this enormous ability to create a link and a kind of relationship with machines much, much better than with human beings. And so before he lands, he gives this encomium to the plane that had taken him across the ocean, and it had been great. And now he was afraid it was going to be destroyed. He begs them to take care of his plane. He, meanwhile, is being hustled off on the shoulders of these soldiers. Two men who had picked him up. And his hat is placed on somebody else. And that is to say, his helmet, leather helmet. And because the helmet was placed on someone else, everybody's focusing on that guy. He, meanwhile, is scooted off to an office in one of the hangars. And this becomes part of a new story. Really, it's the story of how Ambassador Herrick in France takes this guy who had no education, no exposure, no expectation, no knowledge about how he's going to deal, and he's now in the midst of unprecedented situation, and the relationship between France and the United States was quite touchy and thorny. And he could say something, especially in the period of time now when France itself was kind of in mourning over the loss of its pilots. He could say something that would touch off an international incident easily, and Herrick is attuned to that. He makes his way to Lindbergh, tells him, "You stay with me." That took care of Lindbergh's problem about where he was going to stay. And over the next week, Herrick watches over Lindbergh, guides him. And Lindbergh himself is sufficiently modest, willing to listen, understands the situation very quickly, and he's transformed into a world figure within that week. Remember, this was a rough, poorly educated guy who grew up on a farm, who was a member of the barnstorming team, and now he becomes an extraordinary diplomat. Herrick himself is in awe of this machine that he kind of helped create. Hundreds, thousands of possibilities come raining in on him. He could endorse watches, motor oil. He could appear in films. People wanted to sign him up for vaudeville appearances on radio. Millions upon millions of dollars, literally, are offered to him, and Lindbergh maintains this extreme dignity in this period of time when, in the United States, this was the 20s, when money was the one thing that everybody seemed to think that could make anybody do anything in the United States was money. And here was this guy from the Midwest who did not drink, who refused to carouse, who had come to Paris and said that he owed everything that he had accomplished to the great work that has come before him in France, and the flyers, and the two people who disappeared had laid the path, and he was their partner. He set everything right. So I think a large part of the puzzle about what made this such an extraordinary thing was this combination of events. Young man, somebody who was the underdog, somebody whose theory about what the way to make it across the ocean went against everything else that was being accepted, someone who competed against these men who had been dogfighters, and that's a larger point. He was fresh. He was untouched by war. This was, remember, World War II had finished. France was filled with people who were crippled, people who had lost relatives, people to whom World War I was a reference point, and the terrible bloodiness of that war was something that bogged their imagination. And he was someone fresh, untouched by war. He had not served in the war. He had not been in the war. He had not fought anybody. He had not killed anybody. He had shown that you could do something that was brave and great and courageous, and it didn't have to be involved in killing other people. yes, there were others who were heroes in the 20s who captured imaginations, Babe Ruth and Al Capone and people who sat on top of flagpoles, all sorts of diversionary figures. But here was somebody suddenly who had done something really special, and he had done it outside of the context of war, and he had beaten the old warriors who refused to learn about about the way you dealt with modern technology. And he had come to Europe, and the ambassador of the United States presented him as the single best representative of what the United States was. You people in France had been used to, he said, the ugly, he didn't use these terms, but essentially the ugly American, the uneducated, rich person comes around, throws money around, and thinks that everybody's going to bow down to him. This is the real America. And Lindbergh played that role perfectly. And he was impossibly handsome. And he made it alone. Calvin Coolidge, when he welcomed him back, that was the one major point. Here was a man who had kind of tied into the American the American narrative, that is, of individualism, of making it alone. Everybody else had a team. He did it alone. Mm-hmm. And he had the kind of dignity and presence to turn down all this money that wanted to convert him into a commodity. And he kept loyal to his vision about aviation. Mm-hmm. And just a couple of weeks later, Byrd makes it across the ocean. Chamberlain makes it across the ocean. But if you take a look at their flights, which were all kinds of mishaps, both of them almost died in the landing. Landings were crash landings, and they didn't make it to where they had wanted to. And he was this simple flyer in this simple plane who had made it exactly the way he had planned it. He emerges from there a world hero. Everybody wants to have a piece of him. And so, I mean, it's a situation where celebrity rained down upon him, and he did not allow it to crush him at this moment, at this point.
Yeah, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to have you talk just a little bit about how, in a sense, it all goes belly up for him. And you're going to have to do so very quickly, because he after a while, he refuses to play this role that he's been given. Maybe you could talk to us a little bit about that.
Celebrity becomes a challenge for him, and ultimately he gets married. He has a son, and his son is kidnapped, and he holds the tabloids responsible for this because of their intrusions in his privacy. But by this time, Lindbergh is also connected with a man named Alexis Carrel, who is a brilliant scientist, but also a strong racist, a person who had many, many weird theories about immortality, and Lindbergh becomes an acolyte. It's not that Carrel's responsible for what happens to Lindbergh subsequently, because Lindbergh himself was somebody who, as I said before, had a great ability to connect with machines, but not with human beings. He had a great ability to connect with abstract ideas, but not with reality. And he was offended. Remember, by the 1930s, the presidency of the United States, and Lindbergh was a hero for good times. He was unable to deal with the bad times. He was unable to take anything from his heroism and kind of lend it to the American people. By this time, despite the fact that he hadn't sold out, what he had done is to be handled by a group of people who had aviation in mind and used him as the face of aviation. He became very much tied into the idea of helping and promoting air monopolies, and he had made a great deal of money on this. And he had no sense of connection to the common American people. In fact, he thought of them as unruly. He thought of the United States as having become mongrelized by the fact that it had allowed all kinds of races to come into the United States. What had made him a hero were a whole lot of other skills, but he'd been projected and lifted way above his level of competence, and people wanted to know what he thought about all kinds of things that he had no expertise about and no real... in France, he'd been very good at keeping his mouth shut about things that he was not good at. But by the 1930s, he didn't do that. And he fell in love with the notion of regimentation, of control, of power. He flirted with Nazism by the late 1930s. Mm-hmm. He became leader of the American First Committee. He thought that Germany should be the nation behind which the United States should get behind Germany and not behind Britain and France. He had disdain for the democracies, a great love for the totalitarian regimes. And it's the second act of his life, which turns him into a tainted hero. He becomes very unpopular in the United States, although among a small group, that's to say those who favored the neutrality policies and the policies of pro-Nazism in the United States, he becomes their favorite. And has a falling out with President Roosevelt. He's denounced by many cabinet members as pro-Nazi. It's downhill from there. He wants to serve in World War II, Roosevelt, and refuses to give him a commission. He nonetheless finds a way around that, and does serve a little bit in the Asian theater. Because, despite the fact that we were fighting Germany, he did not feel that Germany should be destroyed, but he had a great disdain for Asians and Orientals whom he considered inferior. And this, with his racial theories, he published an article in Reader's Digest about, if you read it, it kind of makes you shiver a little bit about the overt racism. And up in the Asian theater, he flies a number of, a good many, a tens of flights dropping bombs. And later on, we'll talk about how his notion about flight, which was great and it was going to bring peace and so forth, had been corrupted. Mm-hmm. But while he was flying and dropping bombs, it didn't seem to concern him all that much.
Yeah.
Even the fact that he was dropping those bombs over people he had never seen, could not see, and what he was doing was bringing technology to their own destruction. Then there is the third act in the 1950s when he is rehabilitated, very much like our celebrities today.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a truly remarkable story. I mean, I think we say very casually that there are lots of American lives, like that's an American life, but his is really, there's just, there's something about it, which, it makes you very happy about the way Americans do things. And it also makes you very sad, at least me. I mean, it's all kind of in us, in our kind of wacky individuality. I'm not quite sure what to say. I'm not being very eloquent here about it. But in any event, Tom, thank you very much for writing the book. And thank you so much for being on the show. The book is called The Flight of the Century, Charles Lindbergh and the Rise of American Aviation. And I suggest that you go out and buy it and read it, because it is a terrific read. Tom, why don't you close the interview for us by telling us what you're working on now?
Right now, I've started looking at some papers, interesting collection of papers that were the letters that were sent to New York City and to the mayor the day after the World Trade Center was bombed. They are enormously interesting to me, from all over the world, from people of various levels, and what they thought this meant, and just to give us a different insight into September 11th is about.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that sounds like a fantastic and really interesting project. It sounds quite close to home, too.
Very close to home.
I admire you. I don't know if I could I still haven't seen any of the 9/11 movies or any of that business. I don't I don't want to do it yet. I'm not that brave. But anyway, Tom, thank you very much for being on the show. I really enjoyed talking with you today.
Thank you very much.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
You too.
You've been listening to an interview with Tom Kestner about his new book, The Flight of the Century, Charles Lindbergh and the Rise of American Aviation. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.